The White House hosted Colombia's president today. Stopping the flow of cocaine out of the country was at the top of the agenda, but that is a complex proposition.
Cocaine coming from Colombia that is then exported through Ecuador, through Brazil, through the Colombian Atlantic coast into the United States, but also notably into other markets like Europe.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Also on the show, the bitterly cold winter in Ukraine is messing with frontline technology like drones.
The software will tell you it's okay, you can run for another 30 minutes, but you're not. Fortunately, Russians have the same problem.
Plus, solving an ancient mystery about an abandoned city in Southeast Asia and why weather forecasters in Spain are facing threats for talking about climate change.
It was a government conspiracy, he said, to dry out his land and drive him from it.
All those stories and more today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for tuning in with us. Ukraine was subjected to another brutal night. Hundreds of Russian drones and a record 32 ballistic missiles slammed into Ukrainian cities and towns. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said the attack violated a commitment to stop targeting energy infrastructure. Zelensky said Russia was, quote, taking advantage of the coldest days of winter to terrorize people.
Another round of U.S.-brokered peace talks between Ukraine and Russia are scheduled for tomorrow and Thursday. The Trump administration has been working on this for a year now. Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine began almost 4 years ago. Since then, we have checked in periodically with Sergeant Andriy Shadrin. He serves in a military unit that repairs and replaces equipment damaged in frontline fighting in Ukraine's eastern Donbas region. Today, we reached him in the kitchen of his makeshift military base.
I'm cutting my mushrooms into my dinner right now for the whole team.
Shadrin was cooking up a Ukrainian buckwheat dish called grechka. He calls it a comfort food that helps soldiers keep warm. I started by asking him to describe his surroundings.
It's like a makeshift base, partly up the ground, partly underground. Most of life is going beneath the earth level, ground level.
Mm-hmm.
But we have some like storages and bunkers to keep the personnel safe during the impacts.
Right. Drone strikes and the like. Does the equipment you are working on and that people are using at the front lines, does that function properly in this kind of cold?
It's also harder for the equipment to work. Batteries during this cold weather, they are less capable of keeping, storing the electricity. The drone pilots, they suffer.
Their missions have to be shorter because the drone won't stay in the air as long.
Yeah, and they can also lose drones just because the battery was like something like 20 or 25%.
Oh.
So the software will tell you it's okay, you can run for another 30 minutes, but you're not.
These drones are just dropping out of the sky?
Yeah, yeah. Fortunately, Russians have the same problem.
Fortunately. I don't want to make you dwell on this, but can you describe what it feels like out there right now?
When you're on a combat mission and we're in a much better position than the guys from the infantry that have to stay in the trenches and their outposts, like basically foxholes in the ground. Mostly it's feeling like you're constantly cold and nothing can warm you up.
Andriy, I want to ask you about something that happened a couple months ago. I understand you lost a dear friend of yours in the unit in the fall. Can you tell me about your colleague and how he died?
Basically, he was on a regular mission and the vehicle was impacted by a Russian drone a couple kilometers away from the front line. That was a team of three. Two were injured while Victor was killed in action on the spot at the moment of impact. The team that was running that mission, they were helping themselves. That's basically according to MARCH protocol and like common sense.
Mm-hmm.
So they were treating their wounds while they were doing it. The car caught on fire, and basically we could extract the body only when the car burned, like absolutely.
And cooled down, I guess. How long had you been fighting alongside Victor?
4 years.
Since the beginning of the full-scale invasion.
And half a year before the full-scale invasion, we were serving together during the Russian proxy war.
You've sent us over some pictures of Victor holding a cat in one and him on a swing in another. I'm wondering if you can tell me a little bit more about what he was like as a person.
He was the last volunteer contractor we had, like the guy who was not conscripted. Like as I served, he served.
Right. So he volunteered. He raised his hand and volunteered to go to war.
Yeah. And that was one of the greatest guys I've ever known because he was always chill. It was one of the easiest guy to go on a mission with, for sure. Like that's the guy we were delivering gay jokes to each other. That's how close we were.
You were close and you would joke to pass the time.
Yeah, and that's basically what we were doing most of the time, except trying not to die.
I'm speaking with Sergeant Andriy Shadrin, who is fighting near the front line in Ukraine's eastern Donbas region. So now everyone in your unit besides yourself is a conscript instead of a volunteer?
Yeah, I have a unit fully packed with conscripted personnel.
So does your unit feel different to you?
Yeah, sure. Like, basically the guy who was forced to go and the guy who volunteered, they will be of a different quality. They have different mentality. Not better or worse, just it's just another.
I understand that after Victor died, you put in a request to transfer out of a combat role. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, I feel myself not capable of running this position in a proper way anymore. I am very, very afraid to make a mistake that will cause some tragic events or problems for the people I command. And I'm waiting for my paperwork to transfer to another unit.
You've been in combat roles since 2014, is that right, when Russia invaded Crimea? So this is a huge change to ask to no longer be fighting directly.
Well, everything goes to an end. I'm not getting any younger. My knee doesn't regenerate.
You were wounded more than once in the knee, right?
Yeah, once in the knee and once in the head, but like in the head, it was a minor damage, basically a scratch.
Victor, your colleague's funeral was in December. You and your commander attended and met his family. What was that like for you?
I felt guilty. In scientific terms, it is called survivor's guilt.
Yeah.
This time I felt my responsibility. I was in charge of that operation. I was basically the guy who was planning it. I can understand that I did not plan it poorly. Every member of my team did everything right. But in a war with intensivity like this, it is not enough to do everything right. You also need some amount of luck. And Victor was not lucky enough. But on the other hand, I can see there his parents and relatives and family, and you have to say something to them. You have to tell them something, why you're bringing a closed coffin to their home.
What did you say to his parents?
I'm sorry, and Victor was the most awesome guy I ever served with. Basically, it is the hard truth.
You have been defending the Donbas region for years now, more than 4 years, it sounds like. The fate of the Donbas has been a key sticking point in negotiations between Russia and Ukraine. Putin wants it. Zelensky says Ukraine will never give it up. What does the fate of the Donbas, which is a phrase that gets thrown around a lot these days, what does that mean to you personally at this point?
Personally, for me, if there was a guarantee that peace for Ukraine will be sustainable, and Russians will take the Donetsk region. I mean, personally, I would not be against a deal like that. Unfortunately, the negotiations through any other position than a position of force with Russia, with Moscow, is an absolute waste of time.
Sergeant Shadrin, it is a pleasure, as always, to speak with you. I hope you stay safe, and I hope your transfer comes through quickly.
Oh, I hope so.
Sergeant Andriy Shadrin is a Ukrainian soldier serving on the front lines in the eastern Donbas region.
Predicting the weather correctly has never been easy. Forecasters know this because they hear from their audience when a sunny forecast, surprise, turns into rain or snow. But in Spain, the meteorologist's gig is getting even more dicey. In a year of droughts, wildfires, and deadly floods, forecasters who've linked these events to climate change have faced some serious hate, even if their predictions ended up being right. The World's Jerry Haddon reports from Barcelona.
Back in 2023, Spain was in a terrible drought. One TV weatherwoman, Isabel Moreno, took to showing a map of Europe. Day after day, week after week, you could see all the rain falling in northern Europe, but nary a drop here. One day, Moreno decided to lead her forecast with four words: the rain skirts Spain. She says she thought it sounded punchy.
Y claro, me empezaron a llegar decenas y decenas y decenas de mensajes.
And suddenly, I started getting dozens and dozens of threats, she told a Spanish radio station recently. People said, why isn't it raining? Is it because of the little airplanes? They accused me of being part of a conspiracy, insulting me, she said, and threatening my life. The little airplane conspiracy involves a secret cabal of scientists and governments seeding the sky with chemicals that destroy rain clouds. The smoking gun for those who buy into the plot, the so-called white chemtrails in the sky left behind by the planes. This chemtrail conspiracy has been debunked by scientists the world over, but that just makes some people believe it more. Like a farmer I met in southern Spain during that same 2023 drought. We were talking about solar energy, but Antonio Torres kept glancing at the sky behind me.
Mire, la estela esta mañana.
Look at the white tendrils up there, he said, spinning me around. I could see a bunch of what the aviation industry calls condensation trails, or contrails, caused by jet fuel. But for Torres, it was something else.
Todos los días que sale una nube, hay cuatro, cinco o seis aviones.
Every day that we have clouds, he told me, four or five planes appear spraying silver iodide to dissolve them. It was a government conspiracy, he said, to dry out his land and drive him from it. Why? So the solar panel companies could move in. It didn't occur to Torres that Spain's prolonged drought could have been the result of more extreme weather patterns caused by climate change.
Y el implicarnos en contar algo que es incómodo, porque implica que no podemos mantenernos igual.
Spanish public TV weatherman Martín Barrero says when meteorologists weigh in to explain this, it makes some people uncomfortable, because climate change means humanity must change, he says. And some people who are reluctant to accept this become climate change deniers. And worse, he says, they even begin to doubt the daily forecast. And to target the public faces of those forecasts, the friendly and once trusted weatherman or woman.
Las cuentas oficiales de AEMET en la red social X.
Rubén del Campo, with Spain's meteorological agency, says one out of four comments on the agency's posts on X are hateful or threatening. It wears you down, he says. I once saw a post with my picture saying that I'd forbidden people to talk about cold fronts. One out of four is a minority, but del Campo says when you're talking hundreds of thousands of hateful comments on a single post, it can be brutal. There's self-censorship happening among us, he says. The science is still getting done, but fewer meteorologists are willing to show their face to explain it to the world. If you've got important findings, he says, but don't share them publicly, they lose their impact. And if it requires warning the public about extreme weather linked to climate change, he says, and no one steps forward, people's lives could be endangered. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Barcelona.
You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. I want to take you way back in time to around the 13th century. We're in Southeast Asia, wandering the streets of Angkor, the seat of the Khmer Empire. It's a bustling city of about 800,000 residents, making it potentially the largest metropolis in the world at the time. One diplomat from China who traveled to Angkor wrote about its markets.
The local people who know how to trade are all women. Small market transactions are paid for in rice or other grain and Chinese goods.
A voice actor there reading from a journal written by Zhou Daguan in 1296. Zhou spent a year in the capital of the Khmer Empire. He went into great detail in what he saw.
Above the gates are stone Buddha heads. One of them is decorated with gold. In the center of the capital is a gold tower.
The descriptions from Zhou's journal are important because they're pretty much all we have as to what life was like in Angkor, a city that was mysteriously left abandoned in the 14th century. A new documentary from our colleagues at NOVA, Angkor, Hidden Jungle Empire, aims to learn more to solve the mystery. Sarah Claussen is an archaeologist at the University of Colorado in Boulder and one of the contributors to the documentary. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So just start by describing what's left of Angkor today. Like if we were to walk around, what would we see?
The most notable thing that you'll see is these massive stone temples. Angkor is most famous for Angkor Wat, but in addition to Angkor Wat, there are tens of other spectacular temples. Most of the walls of the temples are carved with intricate bas-reliefs, and the bas-reliefs tell us so much about the Angkorian world. Some show us scenes from daily life, others show us scenes from mythology. But if you look beyond the temples, there's this vast engineered landscape, which we've been discovering using various technologies over the last couple of decades at Angkor.
So we know all about the very impressive surviving temples. Underneath all the vegetation that grew over much of the site, though, is what you were pretty sure was more evidence of the seat of the Khmer Empire, and it was LIDAR technology that was crucial in letting you literally see that. I wanted to hear one of your colleagues, Peepal Heng at Yale University, describing the site at the famous Angkor Wat Temple and the challenge that LIDAR was able to overcome.
So here we are in the eastern section of the Angkor Wat enclosure. What I am standing on now, what have been a house mount. And because of the overgrown, we can hardly tell the topographic change, but the LIDAR data shows that we are standing in an urban block that is replicated into other urban blocks covering the entire Angkor Wat enclosure.
Archaeologists, people hang there standing on what was a house mound. So, Sarah, describe what LIDAR is and how it's being used in Angkor.
So the way that LIDAR works is it sends hundreds of thousands of pulses, and then we measure the return of those pulses back to the equipment. Most of those pulses bounce off of vegetation, trees, buildings, things like that. But some of them reach the ground surface. And those are the points that we as archaeologists are interested in because we can use that to reconstruct the ground surface to see what the ground beneath all of this vegetation looks like.
Yeah, I mean, it's really fascinating. What surprised you the most after using LIDAR to map the site at Angkor?
Oh, I mean, the results from the LIDAR are spectacular. And you can look at the LIDAR data even as an untrained specialist and see these remnants of a very complex urban fabric. One of the things that's really important about Angkor for the LIDAR data is that Angkor as a city was built on a floodplain. So in order to deal with the annual monsoons, every single building was built on an artificial mound. So even though the buildings themselves have long decomposed, the mounds remain, and it's those mounds that we're actually seeing in the LIDAR data. So a temple mound, for example, has a different shape than a house mound.
I'm speaking with archaeologist Sarah Claussen, who's part of a new documentary from NOVA called Angkor, Hidden Jungle Empire. So, Sarah, through this LIDAR technology, we are getting a better picture of what life was like in Angkor during its height. What period are we talking about? And at its peak, what was the city like?
So we're talking about a period from about 802 CE. That's kind of where inscriptions give us the start date. Of course, it's a little bit more complicated than that. And then it ends around 1430. Again, also, it's more complicated than a simple number. One of the main sources of evidence is bas-reliefs from one of the temples built by Jayavarman VII called the Bayan. He, in a very unique approach to creating these bas-reliefs showed scenes from everyday life. So we can see a lot of different images of very kind of basic activities. So people at markets, people betting over a cockfight. There's even a scene of a woman giving birth. So that gives us some information about what life would have been like, or some very poignant images of what life would have looked like.
Around 1350, though, things change for Angkor. Here's another clip from the documentary that sets the scene. This is Dan Penny at the University of Sydney in Australia.
It mysteriously was abandoned, or so the story goes. And so this place has attracted the fascination of people from around the world for many, many hundreds of years, partly because the city itself is so prodigiously massive, and partly because all of this was apparently left to the jungle by the Khmer.
Yeah, so Angkor, once the seat of the Khmer Empire, was left to the jungle. What happened, Sarah? I mean, I know the documentary touches upon a few theories.
There are a lot of different hypotheses as to what may have contributed to the decline of the empire. Things like changing patterns with the weather, more extreme monsoons and droughts. But there are also a lot of social factors to be considered as well. So ultimately, it was probably a toxic combination of a number of different factors that contributed to the ultimate decline of Angkor.
So we don't actually know when and why the last inhabitant left Angkor.
Right. And honestly, recent evidence suggests that there wasn't a complete kind of abandonment of Angkor. People probably continue to live there until the present day. There are just fluctuations in population and the number of people living there. What we do know is that the political and religious elite relocated, because we don't have the construction of any of these major temples or any inscriptions after this time period.
Finally, we hear from Dan Penny at the University of Sydney in Australia, whom we heard from a moment ago. He says near the end of the documentary that Angkor and its rise and fall narrative is a warning for the future. What do you think the warning is?
Yeah, so we have a lot to learn by studying the Angkorian world. I think one of the things that's really important to highlight is that this civilization flourished for 500 years. That's a really long time. So there's a lot of positive things that we can take away from it. But it's also an example of a very strong and powerful civilization collapsing or transforming into a different type of political organization. So there are things to be learned in terms of how they manage their natural resources, the importance of political structure, and how power is organized and orchestrated in society.
Sarah Claussen is an archaeologist at the University of Colorado Boulder. She's one of the researchers featured in the new PBS documentary, Angkor, Hidden Jungle Empire, from our colleagues at NOVA. The two-part series is streaming now on YouTube. Sarah, great to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
More stories from around the globe still coming your way this hour. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Tensions are escalating in the waters near Iran, where about a dozen U.S. warships have assembled. The U.S. military said today that one of its Navy jets shot down an Iranian drone, which had approached an American aircraft carrier in international waters. Meanwhile, inside Iran, authorities are carrying out a mass arrest campaign. Rights activists and relatives of the detained say that people have been taken to unknown locations and not allowed contact with loved ones. Arbitrary detention is not new in the Islamic Republic, but activists say the scale of this latest round is unprecedented. The World's Shirin Jafari reports.
It's been some 40 days that Taghi Rahmani hasn't heard from his wife. Rahmani, who's now in Paris, is a political activist and husband of a well-known dissident, Narges Mohammadi. She is a women's rights activist and a Nobel Peace Prize laureate. She's been in and out of jail for her activism. Rahmani tells me that in order to communicate with the outside world, the prison guards demand that his wife follow certain rules. She can only say that the situation inside the prison is good and that she doesn't have any problems.
Narges
Narges says she doesn't want to follow these rules. She says she wants to tell the truth, so they won't let her make a call. Rahmani says his wife is suffering from heart and lung problems, but the prison officials have denied her care. The recent government crackdown on protesters in Iran is unprecedented. Thousands were killed and injured. Many are missing. Desperate and devastated, some families are taking to social media to raise awareness about their missing loved ones. Like this father, Sakhavat Salimi, a political dissident who's been detained in the past himself. There's no sign of my son, he says. I don't know what to do. Salimi, who lives in the north of Iran, explains that his daughter got a mysterious call saying that her brother has been killed. That's it. No additional details. Salimi left his home in the north and traveled to Tehran, the capital, to look for him. He says he searched all the morgues and hospitals. No sign of him.
There are a lot of families who have no idea where their loved ones are. Are they dead? Are they alive? Are they being taken care of? What facility are they in? What town have they even been taken to? Because there's been some transfers of individuals.
Gisu Nia is a human rights lawyer with the Atlantic Council, with deep connections inside Iran. She says there's a wide range of people who've been arrested, doctors, lawyers, teachers, some who were merely passing through protests and not actively participating in them. This week, Iran's Minister of Justice told reporters that some minors have been detained as well. He didn't specify how many. Gisunia says what's taking place in Iran amounts to enforced disappearance, which is a crime against humanity.
The disappeared are basically stripped of all their rights. The families have profound suffering because they don't know what happened to their loved ones. They're operating in an information vacuum. You know, it's definitely considered to be one of the most odious of crimes.
Some of the missing don't have anyone to advocate for them. Some have older parents who aren't able to physically search detention facilities and hospitals.
Right now, the lives of people detained during Iran's recent uprising are in danger.
Some families are under pressure not to speak to the media or publicize their case. Iranians outside of the country are using social media to call attention to the plight of the missing and detained. Despite the unprecedented crackdown, there are reports of sit-ins at some universities across the country. Like this one in the southern city of Shiraz, where students demand the release of medical professionals who've been arrested for treating injured protesters. The situation in Iran is not normal, says Taghi Rahmani, husband of Nobel Peace Prize winner Narges Mohammadi. The Trump administration says it's negotiating with the Iranian government. They should include the issue of the detained and missing in those negotiations, Rahmani says. He adds that the government carried out a massacre on the streets. Another one is silently taking place inside prisons. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
The small Mexican village of El Bosque is getting submerged by rising seas. You may have heard our story on the village yesterday. Today we head inland to where El Bosque's residents were moved and given 51 brand new homes. From the Sea Change podcast at Public Radio WWNO in New Orleans, Alvaro Cespedes visits the city of Frontera to see how the new El Bosque compares to the old one.
I visited El Nuevo Bosque, Spanish for the New Bosque, as this place is known, in mid-February. The ferocious summer heat was still months away, but people's clothes and my own were all soaking with sweat. El Bosque, the old one, is just 7 miles away, but in the new one, the sun just hits differently. The sound of the soft breeze is replaced by the roaring of passing trucks. There are simply no trees, and so the only place where people can take refuge from the unforgiving Tabasco sun is inside their newly built gray brick houses. It still smells new, with very clean concrete streets and rows of houses, all identical and tightly packed together, freshly painted.
es este olor del mar, porque mi casa sí estaba más cerca del mar.
It's the smell of the sea. My house was closer to the sea. That smell that used to wake you up in the morning. It's not the same anymore.
That's Cristina Pacheco, Lupe's sister. She's 3 years younger, but her expressions are almost identical. And they both share a deep and long-running love for the town they once called home. She welcomes me into her new house.
Pues sí, estamos contentos.
Yeah, we're happy. We're happy. But it's not what we wanted, because we had our whole life built in El Bosque. We had fishing gear, but I lost it all.
Lancha sierrera. Nosotros en lo particular teníamos lanchas sierreras.
Cristina lost her home on Christmas Eve 2023 while she was preparing to celebrate with her family. Waves started to come in through the doors and windows, and she knew she had to leave right away. Between that day and the delivery of her home in El Nuevo Bosque, nearly a year passed in which she had to rent, stay in borrowed spaces, and spend nights in shelters.
I had a painting my son-in-law made for me of El Bosque. The lighthouse, the sea, the trees, the palms. The sun was setting.
Lo primero que me despertaba era mirarlo porque era como la salida del sol, la puesta de sol.
That's the first thing I'd see in the morning. Then I'd open my window and look out at my garden, the flowers I had planted. Then I'd look toward the river.
Ya miraba yo para el río, porque esa vista era para el río.
Cristina, like everyone we spoke with, refers to where they now live as the city. It is essentially the opposite of El Bosque, big, unfamiliar, and far from the sea. Cristina and her neighbor's way of life changed ever since they stopped fishing. Even their diet. They used to eat fish and jaiba, soft-shell crab, for almost every meal. Now they have to settle with eating a lot more eggs and chicken.
Te cambia la vida.
It changes your life. It's a radical change. From the fishing life we were used to, I'd get up and get my gear. Then we'd bring back some fish and make fresh breakfast.
The landscape has changed drastically. Instead of the sea, they now look out their windows and see grassy fields where cows graze.
My mom and I had to go to a psychologist to accept. To accept that we had lost everything. That there was nothing left to do but wait and see what would happen to us.
Like all the houses in El Nuevo Bosque, Cristina's has 3 bedrooms, a small kitchen, a living dining area, and a laundry space outside. The entire El Nuevo Bosque project cost 38 million pesos. That's around $2 million. Still, they've lost so much.
Los niños de primaria.
Los niños de primaria están tomando clases aquí mismo en la colonia.
The primary school kids are taking classes right here in the neighborhood. They don't have a school, so they study outdoors. A neighbor lends them a chair, a table, and the teacher gives class there.
El Bosque used to have 3 churches, 2 evangelical and 1 Catholic. Now they have none. The pine trees and palm trees that gave such needed shade to cool down in El Bosque are also gone. The park in which kids used to play baseball now has been replaced with streets that reflect the blistering sun. But what people miss the most is going out to the ocean to fish. That is what made the community bind together. Coming and going to El Bosque to go fishing now implies transportation costs that most are unable to afford.
When we go fishing, when my husband and I want to go, we have to take our motorcycle. That's 50 pesos for a round trip. And if we want to go again later, that's another 100 pesos. It's tough.
The next day, we go to El Bosque, the original Bosque, Lupa is there in her outdoor kitchen, making breakfast with her husband and daughter. On the menu is fresh fried fish with pico de gallo and tortillas.
Entonces, al venir al bosque, nos giró la vida. Obvio que sí.
Coming to El Bosque turned our lives around. Of course it did. In the countryside, to earn a peso, a week had to go by. But here, you go fishing, and if you catch something today, they pay you today. The money is right there. Who wouldn't want that? I've always said, you get used to the good life. But our lives changed again when climate change came. That's when our lives were uprooted.
Lupe is one of the very last people who have decided to stay here. Her house is still not in the way of the water. At least, not yet. Even though Lupe fought so hard for a safe new home for her community, she herself hasn't left.
Every morning, when I wake up, the first thing I see is the river. I take 3, 4, 5 steps, and I'm at the sea. El Bosque is so beautiful. It shines even with broken wings.
According to experts we talked to, the communities of Sánchez Magallanes and Chiltepec, also in the state of Tabasco, are beginning to suffer the effects of coastal erosion, which could eventually lead to a similar situation to that of El Bosque. The fact that Tabasco is so flat, with so much rainfall, rivers, and swampy areas, doesn't help. But that doesn't mean that people living in these villages will be recognized as refugees and relocated, like what happened in El Bosque. This is still not official public policy. In some ways, El Bosque beat the odds. How did they do it? First, the village got organized and they raised their voices and their fists. They trusted the right person, Lupe, into managing relationships with lawyers, activists, advisors, scientists, and government officials. It also helped that the president came from the same area and showed empathy towards the people there. In a country like Mexico, that is definitely not unusual.
Today, we are the first community displaced by climate change, but we won't be the last. So what's going to happen?
Most nights, Lupe and her husband are the only ones who sleep in El Bosque. Even though she has a clean, new house 7 miles inland in El Nuevo Bosque, surrounded by her former neighbors. But it's not her home. Her home is here, next to the ocean.
I'm going to hold on to El Bosque till the final breath, until they tell me, you can't live in this house anymore. You have to leave. But I'll stay till the end.
Pero lo hago porque quiero.
And I do it because I want to.
That was reporter Alvaro Cespedes with the WWNO podcast, Sea Change.
A teenager in Australia insists that he is no hero, but he does kind of sound like one. 13-year-old Austin Appleby swam 2.5 miles to get help for his mother and 2 siblings after they were swept out to sea.
The family was on vacation, enjoying a day on the water in kayaks and paddleboards. The wind picked up, the ocean got choppy, and they were pulled away from shore. That's when Austin's mother, Joanne, told him to swim back for help.
One of the hardest decisions I ever had to make, because to say to Austin, try and get to shore and get some help. It's could get really serious really quickly.
That's Joanne speaking to local news. Austin set out with his life jacket on in an inflatable kayak, which he eventually had to ditch after it took on water. He also took off the life jacket because it was slowing him down. Austin picks up his story.
And yeah, I just said, all right, not today, not today, not today. I had to keep on going.
He swam the remaining 2.5 miles to shore unassisted. It took him about 4 hours to reach land, where he called for help. Authorities sent a helicopter and found Austin's mother and siblings a full 9 miles from shore, nearly 10 hours since they embarked.
I didn't think I was a hero, Austin told the BBC. I just did what I did.
Still ahead on the show, the president of Colombia comes to the White House. Drugs are at the top of the agenda. Our guest explains why. That is next here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. President Gustavo Petro of Colombia met with President Donald Trump at the White House today. The meeting was held behind closed doors. It followed months of barbs exchanged between the two leaders. Recently, Trump accused Petro of being a drug lord and threatened U.S. military intervention. Petro has called Trump an accomplice to genocide in Gaza. Earlier today, I spoke with Elizabeth Dickinson, who's based in Colombia's capital, Bogota. She's an expert on Latin America with the International Crisis Group. I asked her what she thought the goals were going into today's meeting at the White House.
So after months of both Trump and Petro using their mutual dispute for political purposes, Petro is there to calm tensions and, frankly, to save his hide. I really think there was an element of fear that was inspired in Petro after receiving these threats from Trump following the real military action in Caracas. Petro, of course, also was personally sanctioned along with several family members and one of his ministers back in October. And I would expect that he is hoping to lobby for those sanctions to be removed.
But Petro was pretty critical about the situation in Venezuela after the capture of Maduro. Are you surprised that he did not become more aggressive toward Washington?
So I think Trump and Petro have something in common. They both speak their minds, and particularly when they're in front of a crowd. And Petro is very clearly opposed to a number of U.S. policies in the region. Petro himself is a very interesting leader, the first elected left-wing leader in Colombia in many decades, himself a demobilized former urban guerrilla fighter. And I think that he has used this fight with Trump really to play to his base.
So let's settle into what was expected to be high on the agenda at their meeting at the White House today, drugs. How serious is cocaine trafficking in Colombia today? Give us a sense of the scale right now.
Well, Colombia is the largest producer in the world of the raw material that's used to produce cocaine, that is coca, and it's profitable for farmers. So cocaine coming from Colombia that is then exported through Ecuador, through Brazil, through the Colombian Atlantic coast into the United States, but also notably into other markets like Europe, which is actually today's largest and fastest growing cocaine market. So essentially for Colombia, drug trafficking is the problem. And here I really want to emphasize that if anyone understands the gravity of the situation, it's a country that has lived for more than half a century locked in civil conflict, fueled by groups that fund themselves with drug trafficking. Initially, rebel insurgencies. Then today we have a whole mix of criminal groups that enrich themselves through drug trafficking, illegal gold mining, and other businesses, and have destabilized, I think, the security for millions of Colombians, particularly in rural areas. Colombia really wants to fix this. It's just simply not an easy problem.
I'm speaking with analyst Elizabeth Dickinson with the Crisis Group. She's in Bogota. What has been Colombia's traditional strategy to tackle cocaine trafficking, and how has it changed under Gustavo Petro?
For many decades, Colombia went after cocaine supply by forcibly eradicating the crops. That was initially done through aerial spraying with pesticides. But a court in Colombia actually outlawed this practice because of the dramatic health and environmental effects that were documented. We're talking about miscarriages among women, children becoming very ill. So the effect was really quite devastating. What has happened under the Petro administration is that he has shifted towards interdiction and seizures as the core of his strategy. And the argument is the following. Many of the farmers who grow coca are small-time, poor, rural farmers who don't have a lot of other options. And eradicating their crops often left them poorer and more vulnerable to criminal exploitation. What the Petro administration argues is, we got to go after these guys where they're actually making the money, which is where the cocaine is, the trafficking, and sort of take the bounty of the drug trade, the cocaine itself, in order to hit the pocketbooks of these criminal organizations. And as a result, Colombia over the last 3 years has seen record levels of seizures and interdictions of drugs. Now, the United States looks at that and compares it to the satellite images that they're seeing of Colombia. And they see Colombia today is home to more coca crop than at any point since they began monitoring.
That's incredible.
And here is where the dispute lies. Petro says, we got to protect the small farmers. We got to go after the big criminals. The United States says, yeah, but look at how many hectares of coca you have. And this is the crux of the dispute.
Would you argue, Elizabeth, that by going after the drug dealers, the cartels, and not the farmers, that it's made it easier to produce while Petro is attempting to cut off the heads of the hydras?
This is a problem that is truly a bit of a whack-a-mole. You can hit it one place and it sort of moves to another. Because fumigation and aerial spraying is illegal in Colombia, what eradication requires is that soldiers and police deploy to areas that are dominated by armed and criminal groups and manually, with their hands, rip up crop by crop the coca plants. Now, what that requires is a deployment of troops to first create a perimeter around the area. It requires landmine sweepers because criminal groups put landmines near the coca to prevent their eradication. And it requires aerial support in case of evacuation. So we are talking about tens of thousands of dollars that are being spent to eradicate 1 hectare of coca. The use of resources is very hard to justify here in Colombia, a country that is experiencing active armed conflict and where security forces are desperately needed, not to do jobs like that, but to protect the population from criminal groups that are preying upon them.
Is there any interest in the U.S. in supporting those efforts?
The U.S. has traditionally supported eradication efforts. For example, paying for the fuel that goes in the helicopters, maintaining those Black Hawk helicopters, providing more financing for the anti-narcotics police. The hard question here is that you can pay for things. What you can't pay for is people. And there is a limited number of security forces here in Colombia, and they're needed across the country.
Today, with Trump and Petro meeting in Washington, what opportunities exist for further collaboration, especially if you feel that Trump's actions in Venezuela brought the Colombian president to heel? I mean, he's a lame duck, right, with elections coming up in May.
I think that Petro will be looking to prove to his electorate that the left in Colombia is capable of managing relations with the United States. This has become an electoral issue in which the opposition has asked, this is our most important bilateral relationship. The United States is not only the most important security partner, but also the largest trade partner. Hundreds of American businesses operating here. And so I think we'll try to prove that he is capable of managing that relationship. The United States, for its part, will be asking for pretty concrete things. I think they will be asking for those eradication alternatives. They'll be asking as well for extraditions. There are individuals that the United States has identified that it believes are involved in drug trafficking that are essentially a short list and a long list that they've given to Colombia of who they want sent to the United States to face due process.
That was Elizabeth Dickinson in Bogota, Colombia. She is the Latin America Deputy Director with the International Crisis Group.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Join us right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Judy Piggott, the Gruber Family Foundation, the Schmidt Family Foundation, and Gavin Salmanese, LLC. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.